Welcome to the program, Piers Cunningham with you. It's been a while since I've posted to Beyond Infinity, but better late than never, as they say. I thought I'd revert to a subject that is close to my heart, and I hope that my listeners will appreciate this and know that there's a fair amount of stuff on our website, beyondinfinity.com.au, about space and space exploration, you know, which I find a fascinating subject. So even though my posts may have been fairly silent over the last few months, I have been keeping track of the news and watching with interest the launches of the latest starships. In fact, I believe there's one coming up quite soon in the next, hopefully in the next, you know, 2 or 3 weeks, we could be seeing the fourth Super Heavy launch of the Starship, and progressively ironing out the problems along the way and making it into orbit and performing some milestones there. A few things that come up in the space area, if you like, that the great extended mission that's happened with Juno, which is a solar-powered spacecraft in orbit around Jupiter, big looping orbit, which takes it far away from Jupiter into the realm of the Jovian moons and then back in for a close pass of the planet. It's finished its study of the atmosphere of Jupiter, and that was the prime mission, and it's now in an extended mission phase, which is, and it's looking at the moons, and in particular some of the photos have been sent back recently of, you know, high resolution surface images of Europa and also Io are both amazing, and the highest resolution closest photos that have been taken for many years, I think going back to the Galileo mission of the 1990s. So we've been spoilt there, and there's more to come. Every sort of few months, we're getting close flybys of different moons of Jupiter. So I'll be looking forward to that. But there is some great stuff there to have a look at. So you just Google Mission Juno and you'll find the homepage with some great images. And that whole thing that's going on with engagement with the public and people who are actually, you know, citizen scientists who are processing the images that have been taken by Juno, and coming up with some amazing stuff. So kind of NASA outsourcing some of the work there to the public, but getting some great results. And that's actually a good segue into another thing that's going on, which is Mars. And there's two great rover missions still active on the surface. One's Curiosity at Gale Crater, and the other is at Jezero Crater called Perseverance. Perseverance carried a little drone helicopter, which after far exceeding its warranty, it has finally gone silent. And that's because it actually landed on uneven surface and touched one of its rotor blades on the ground. Well, this propeller was traveling very quickly, and it's not really designed to make contact with solid objects. So a little chip, a little piece was snapped off the end of one of the rotor blades, and that's meant that helicopter can't fly anymore. But as I said, it far exceeded its initial expectations and has shown that a great way to explore not just Mars but other worlds in our solar system is using helicopters or quadcopters or things that can fly around instead of using wheels. So, you know, we started off with stationary landers, then we got rovers happening, and that was shown to be a great concept back in the 90s with the Pathfinder mission, and then Spirit of Opportunity followed that. And now we've got Curiosity and Perseverance, which are nuclear powered, so they'll be there for a while, provided their wheels hold up and other mechanical components that suffer from wear and tear. And then the next step beyond rovers is going to, as proved by Ingenuity, is to have helicopters, things that can fly, hop around, get into inaccessible terrain, really open up the terrain on Mars. And so the next mission very likely will be something that flies, this next surface mission, something that can land in multiple locations and allow us to really get into some interesting areas of Mars. For example, Valles Marineris, which is one of the biggest canyon systems, dwarfs the Grand Canyon in America. It'd be possible to fly inside that very, very spectacular and deep and enormous canyon system on Mars. So that'll be one great thing to keep an eye out for. Also polar regions, the Olympus Mons, some of the extinct volcanoes, enormous shield volcanoes that Mars has, will also be able to be explored in more detail using a flying craft such as Ingenuity, but with a lot more instruments on board. So that's exciting. And we were talking just before about outsourcing the imagery from Juno and having citizen scientists process it and then upload it to the Mission Juno website. Well, just recently, a review was done of the sample return mission. So Perseverance is collecting samples, putting them in these little hermetically sealed containers and caching them in different spots on the surface of Mars. The idea is that a separate mission comes along, lands near this cache of samples, which have been very carefully taken by Perseverance. Those are hoped to reveal possible signs of ancient life or lack of, give us much more, a far greater insight into what the surface is like and what conditions, environmental conditions are like now, but also in the distant past on the Red Planet. But it's very expensive to get that mission to do what it needs to do, which is to go to Mars, land on the surface, collect these tubes, get them up into orbit, transfer them to another spacecraft, and then return them to Earth, where they're hopefully going to land in the Utah desert. So NASA was, going down this path of, well, we'll do this. This is a mission that we'll do with our other partners, for example, the European Space Agency and others. JAXA is another one that's involved. But the costs have come back, $11 billion, and not returning them until the year 2040. So 16 years away. And that is not acceptable to NASA. Too costly and too long a time frame. The scientists involved want these things to look at themselves. They don't want to be looking, they don't want their children looking at them or another generation. So they've put out the call to the private sector for anyone really to come forward with a plan that saves money and is reliable and likely to get the result they want, which is to get those sample tubes back from Jezero Crater and safely returned for analysis, detailed analysis in laboratories on Earth. If you recall back in the 1960s with the Apollo mission, the 60s and early 70s, one of the great legacies of that was the large quantities of hand-picked samples that were returned from the surface of the moon by the astronauts and remain in laboratories and have been shared around the world to different places and different universities and scientific institutions for analysis. So as a result of that, we know a lot more about the moon. In fact, there's a lot of similarity between rocks on the moon and rocks on Earth, which is indicative of the shared history of the two bodies. But going back to the need for the private sector to be involved, they are calling for help from the private sector. I think until that happens, the whole sample return idea is in limbo and really up in the air. Now, that brings me to another matter which relates to Mars. Many listeners will be aware that Elon Musk is talking about trying to have a Mars colony, and he's developing this super heavy rocket with Starlink. Starlink, incidentally, I think that the usable volume inside a Starlink spacecraft is in the order of the usable volume of the International Space Station, which took multiple dozens of space shuttle launches to get all the components up to low Earth orbit, where it is about 400 kilometers above the surface, 450 kilometers above the surface, and then get all the modules attached together and the big solar panels and all the things up there. And that's been a great success. It's been a great international collaboration. We've learned a lot about long-term effects of exposure to microgravity, how plants grow up there, how physiology responds to long exposure to space, and how people, psychologically deal with being in orbit and being in confined space and a long way from home. And these are the sort of lessons which we're going to need to know about if we're going to send people to Mars per Elon Musk's plan. Just a little bit of info on Starship and the Super Heavy launcher. It's the most powerful launch system ever developed, according to the SpaceX website, able to carry up to 100 people on long duration interplanetary flights, also enable satellite delivery development of a moon base and point-to-point transport here on Earth. And it should be added that the Artemis program, which is NASA's return to the moon, put astronauts back on the moon, supposed to happen this decade. Hard to see that happening, harder to see that happening. But integral to that, the success of that plan is the involvement of SpaceX and other private companies, but SpaceX in particular, because it's, I think it's going to provide the lander that's going to transport astronauts down to the surface of the moon. Again, NASA really relying on the private sector to help it achieve its aims. One of the reasons why they're having to do that is that the costs are so high, especially when you compare it with reusable spacecraft like what SpaceX has developed with the Falcon 9, I think able to be used up to 20 times. Some of the older ones have done at least 20 journeys up to space, dropped off their cargo of satellites and other objects, and then returned and landed safely either on a drone ship out in the water or back at Cape Canaveral or elsewhere in the United States. So reusability has brought down the cost of space flight, and it's suggested that if Starship really gets going and evolves to be reliable, and it's going to give a huge boost to capability and allow very large payloads to be launched. Very quickly getting very large capacity being put into low Earth orbit, and then the idea is to go on to Mars. And this brings me to the, to the main point of this discussion today, and that is potential problems that go with having a Mars colony. Even though there's lots of fanboys and lots of people who are very inspired by Elon Musk, I'm one of them. You know, I find it extremely exciting that he's doing what he's doing, and I watch the launches of especially the Super Heavy with the Starship on top with a lot of interest and excitement. But there are people who are not so confident about this. They sort of say that, well, you're sending people possibly to their deaths. You're sending them to a frozen desert with very little atmosphere, not much gravity, and not really a lot to recommend it as a place for human habitation. So I thought I'd run through a few of the arguments for and against that and then finish off with a couple of quotes, which I think are kind of interesting as well. As far as the potential drawbacks of going to Mars is concerned, the lack of food, water, energy, and freedom of movement are things that are highlighted. Because you can't go outside without a space suit, and you'll have limited time out there because you'll have to carry your oxygen with you as you do on the moon, you are going to be confined to the base that you're living in. That base may have to be underground to give you shielding from the dangerous radiation that exists on the surface of Mars. So it's 1/100th the density of the atmosphere on the surface of the Earth. It's a very, very thin atmosphere. Mars has lost its atmosphere over time. There's an orbiter called MAVEN, which has studied the process by which Mars has lost its atmosphere over time, and it's still in the process. It's still happening. The solar wind is blowing the atmosphere off into space from Mars. So there's very little atmosphere there. If you've got the enough equipment and hardware on the ground, you may be able to produce water from the polar areas and from frozen deposits that exist on the surface. That's going to require a lot of energy. You're going to probably have to have nuclear power, sort of mini nuclear power plants transported to the surface of Mars. Again, there's technical problems with doing that. There's safety issues in launching that kind of equipment through the Earth's atmosphere to get it to Mars. Just getting the food for your journey alone is going to be that food required by colonists is going to be very heavy and costly to transport. Apparently, each meal on the International Space Station costs thousands of dollars. Even though they're bringing down, Musk is bringing down, SpaceX is bringing down the cost of launching into space, when you're going a long distance, you're going to need a lot of supplies just for the journey alone, let alone when you get to Mars. And that's going to eat into your cargo capacity, and it's going to require multiple launches. As I said, very high radiation on the surface and on the way to Mars in space. If it's a colony that's going to be built there, what are the long-term effects on babies in utero on the surface of Mars? That's something that I don't think, you know, that there hasn't been any studies I'm aware of done on the International Space Station about that, but that will be a vital thing to know if you're going to have a colony, a multi-generational permanent base there. That will be something that we need to know about. Another comment people have made is, if you can't save the Earth, then what makes you think you can adapt to a place that's already very inhospitable, like Mars? Don't think that Mars is going to provide any kind of real benefit over the Earth. In fact, it's a much, much worse place to live. Life has evolved to suit the environment that Earth has. Life has not evolved, as far as we know, and certainly not our form of life, has not evolved to suit the harsh Martian environment. Terraforming is a thing that's been cited for what you could do with Mars. Could you, you know, release large amounts? I think it was even, you know, Musk had toyed with the idea of nuking the poles of Mars and releasing a whole lot of water vapor into the atmosphere, and maybe this would help warm the place up, put more moisture into the system. As I said, the MAVEN orbiter has shown how solar wind has stripped Mars' atmosphere over billions of years. There's little magnetic field there to hold atmosphere or protect the surface from cosmic radiation. So the radiation environment is something you're going to have to really protect yourself against. Even if you did somehow release a lot of moisture into the atmosphere, that trend, which has been going on for time immemorial on Mars, of losing the atmosphere, you know, what would stop you just losing any atmosphere you created through terraforming? A large colony living in domed cities seems unlikely. It's going to be expensive to get that there. Certainly in the time frame that Musk has set out, you know, it's conceivable that eventually that, you know, there would be some kind of colony on Mars, but over what sort of time frame? I mean, maybe 200 years, 500 years from now, if everything goes sort of in a lineal and sort of accelerating progression. A lot of new technologies required, a hell of a lot of material to be taken from Earth to Mars, and obviously that's going to require regular visits from Earth, supply ships and the like. The human side of going to Mars, you know, the effect on colonists going there, it's likely to be a one-way trip. What are the psychological problems flowing from the isolation, confinement, and the necessarily tightly managed food, consumables and survival resources? You won't be able to just go and decide, oh, I want to have three times the meal. I want to go and have a beautiful Italian meal, or I want to go and eat Thai takeaway or something. That won't necessarily exist, certainly not in the early days. And it's quite likely that a very strong system of government would be required to ensure the survival of the group, i.e. to protect resources, to ensure rationing takes place as it's supposed to. Australia, where I'm from, was originally a British penal colony, and you could get sent here for stealing a loaf of bread. A lot of people died on the journey. It took a long time to get here. At the time, it was almost considered like being sent to Mars. It was literally, in Victorian times, it was a way of just offloading what they didn't want to deal with in Britain. It turns out that Australia worked out pretty well for Australia. So, but initially the conditions were tough. It was a tough place to be for early settlers. So I think you could assume the same will apply on Mars. Certainly the early days of establishing the colony. So these are all negatives, but I think that there are some positives. And I guess you have to start somewhere is one thing. If you want to be a kind of space-faring civilization, the first place you've got to go to is, well, to the moon, I think, first. You hone your skills on the moon. That's part of the plan. And then go to Mars, because it's definitely the most habitable, closest terrestrial planet that we have in our solar system. So it makes sense to go there. Once you've got that skill going, then branch out and go further within our solar system and then to other locations. One thing that really might kick things off in favor of a Mars colony would be a breakthrough with fusion energy, fusion electricity generation. You know, if that could be something that was cost-effective, compact, unleashing endless, clean and cheap energy, that would be a huge catalyst for all sorts of things, obviously on Earth as well, but also on Mars, because it would allow you to to be able to do all sorts of things, you know, make that city possible, because it's going to be an energy hungry operation. You know, you're going to need to be able to potentially convert water that exists on the surface to spacecraft fuel, and also for heating, for food processing, for lights, for your hydroponic gardens that you're growing your veggies in. You know, all this sort of thing is going to be very energy intensive. So a clean, reliable and plentiful means of generating energy would be a big breakthrough that would make things a lot easier. But we've got to start somewhere if we want to explore the universe. A couple of quotes just to wrap things up. I think I've spoken enough for now. This one's from a guy called William Hutchinson Murray, and it's a good one. Until one is committed, there is hesitancy, the chance to draw back. Concerning all acts of initiative and creation, there is one elementary truth, the ignorance of which kills countless ideas and splendid plans. That the moment one definitely commits oneself, then providence moves too. All sorts of things occur to help one that would never otherwise have occurred. A whole stream of events issues from the decision, raising in one's favour all manner of unforeseen incidents and meetings and material assistance, which no man could have dreamed would have come his way. Whatever you can do or dream you can do, begin it. Boldness has genius, power, and magic in it. Begin it now. So, sage words from William Hutchinson Murray, and maybe that is part of what motivates the likes of Elon Musk. But yeah, that's it from me for now. Interested in you know, thinking further about this. Hope you enjoyed the listen, and stay tuned. There'll be more.